I remember sitting beside Steve Iserman and him asking me who was shooting. I had no idea. But that meant it wasn't us. Coach Mark Crawford called up Theo Fleury, Joe Neuwendyke, Eric Lindros, Brendan Shanahan, and Ray Bourque. Incredible talent in that group, and all clutch guys. Plus, I knew that Patrick Waugh was just as good as Hasek at the other end. My first thought was, we're going to win this over the five shots. Then Hasek stopped Theo, and their first shooter, Robert Reichel, scored. Waugh could shut the door, but we still had to get one. Bourque was stopped. Then Neuwendyke. Lindros was up next for us. He went in at full speed, head-faked Hasek to the ice, then hit the post with a backhander. Two shooters left, one for each team. Jaromir Jagr had a chance to put it out of reach, but he hit the post too. That left Shanahan. He tried to pull the puck to Hasek's glove side, but Dominic outweighted him and he ran out of space. We were crushed. Such an empty feeling. We hadn't even lost the game. We were knocked out of the tournament because of an event. If you lose in the NHL, you go home. And when you go to world tournaments, you go to win a gold medal. And now here we were, playing the Finns for third. That game, playing for bronze, was the worst game ever. It was so bad, I used to joke that I'd rather have played in an all-star game. In a way, that's a good thing. Because from midget hockey through to world juniors, Team Canada is taught that it's gold or nothing. I think that puts a lot more pressure on Team Canada than other countries have to handle, though. You need guys who can handle that pressure. In my view, we should have taken Mark Messier to Nagano. His experience and his ability to play his best under pressure would have been huge assets. But I know why we went in the direction we did in 1998. We lost in 1996. And when you lose, you adjust and get better. That's why the decision was made to take one of us, but not both. And yet, when the margin between defeat and victory was so close, there was no doubt in my mind that Mark would have made the difference. It was such a hard game for us to play. It was so miserable. It really was. Throughout my entire career, I tried to win every single game I ever played. I hated losing. But it was better for hockey when Jari Kurri and the Finns beat us and won the bronze medal, because it meant way more to their country. Finland is smaller, and winning that medal helped build their hockey program. Obviously, the team was very depressed after that game. The question was, do we charter home Saturday, or do we stay for the closing ceremony on Sunday? All of us voted to stay. If we'd won the gold medal, we would have stayed, and so it wouldn't be right to leave just because we lost. We'd played so well all the way through, and then to lose on a shootout? It doesn't keep me up nights, but it still bites. After the tournament ended and I retired, Bobby Clark sent Bob Nicholson a letter saying that I should be the director of the 2002 Olympic team. Bob and I met a few times, and I talked about my thoughts and ideas. I told him that I wanted a smaller management group, and that I wanted to hire a head coach who understood the importance of being on the same page as the players, because you really only have 10 days to win gold. The coach has got to be the kind of guy who'd not only give his assistants things to do, but give them actual responsibility. I also told him that I thought Pat Quinn would be the perfect choice. And so Bob Nicholson really took a big chance when he stepped outside the box, and instead of hiring an active NHL general manager, he hired me. The first guy I hired was Kevin Lowe, because we look at the game the exact same way. Then we hired Steve Tambellini and Lanny McDonald. What a great group. When we picked the team, we picked it as a group. You choose guys on the basis of 2 really good years or 8 good career years. Everyone had a say, but the one guy I pushed for was Theo Fleury. I'd played against him for years, and had always found him to be a gutsy, big-game player. Theo was going through some hard times at that point, and so I called him up. I didn't have to ask him to make any promises. I knew he'd do what he needed to do. I have to tell you, there were times when I was genuinely scared for our team. Not after our first game, when we lost to Sweden 5-2, but after game 2 against Germany. We'd been up 3-0, and then Rob Blake took a 5-minute major, and they scored 2 power play goals. We won 3-2, but it was a really ugly game. Germany should have been a tune-up game for us, but it was a real struggle. So we were in the car driving back from the Peaks Ice Arena in Provo, Utah, and I felt genuinely sick, as in physically nauseated. I thought, wow, we're in trouble here. Meanwhile, the Americans were flying, and that made it worse. I thought, what's wrong with Canada? The Americans are taking over. The only thing that kept me going was the thought that in 98, we'd been flying through too. And that had ended pretty abruptly. Lanny McDonald was so positive. He kept saying, don't worry, this is going to be fine. We're going to be fine. This team is good. Curtis Joseph was a great goalie that year. Pat Quinn was coaching him in Toronto. He would end his season 29-17-5. There was no question that he deserved to start game 1. But Marty Brodeur was a really good goaltender too. So we came up with a plan. Curtis would play game 1, and if we won it, Marty would play game 2, and Curtis would play game 3. But if we lost game 1, and Marty won game 2, he'd play game 3, which is what happened. When you're playing in the Olympics, you can't afford to make 1 mistake. You're playing with the best of the best. There are 300 to 400 other players who want to be in your shoes. Sometimes there's a problem if you go with a hot hand and he gets injured in the 3rd or 4th game. Where does that leave the second guy? His confidence will be down. And yet Curtis understood, because Marty had been his backup at both the World Cup of Hockey and the IIHF World Championships in 1996. So even though it was tough for Curtis not to be in net, he was really positive. As the years went on, I got to know Curtis really well. He's one of the best people in the world. Nothing but class. It can be hard when we all have such pride as athletes. Everyone wants to be a part of the game. Listen, a good team guy will say, whatever is best for the team. But deep down, a great athlete is saying, I wish that was me. Back in 98, when I was sitting the bench during the shootout, yeah, I wish I had been one of the 5 guys tapped. But if you don't think that way, you don't make it. Ed Belfour backed up Marty and Curtis. His attitude is pretty typical of most Canadian players, and it shows you why Canadians have been so successful in international competition. When we were putting the team together, I called Ed up and said, listen, you're going to be the 3rd guy, and if that doesn't work for you, I get it. No one will know I asked you. Ed said, are you crazy? I'm definitely going to be there, and I'll be the team's biggest cheerleader. He was so gung-ho, scouting teams and helping our goalies. It was pretty remarkable. Then we played the Czechs and tied 3-3, and that was the game where I took off on a spontaneous rant at the press conference. I was frustrated. When you're the guy running the show, if you don't win, you take all the bullets, and rightly so. But you know when you're shaving or in the shower and you have talks with yourself? When you take all the injustices and all the insecurities that have been swirling around at the back of your mind and you argue them out? We hadn't won gold since 1952. And here we were, 1-1-1. I was thinking again, what's wrong with Canada? The Americans are undefeated. And so when Paul Romanuk asked me a silly question about our NHL guys taking so long to get rolling because they lacked respect for the international game, I started to heat up. Our guys weren't just out there coasting. I thought about the game against the Czechs. They had a great team with Hasek and Jager, but we'd played really well in the third period, outskating them while the Czechs were doing everything they could to slow us down. Plus, when Theo Fleury was standing in front of the net and Roman Hammerlick gave him a wicked cross-check in the back, there was no call. I got emotional. I said, I don't think we dislike those countries as much as they hate us. They love beating us, and we got to get that same feeling toward them. And it just sort of manifested to a point where I remember saying that there was a spear and a cross-check in the same play, and that if we'd done that, it would have been a big story. I kind of went off about how there were four or five blatant penalties that weren't called. And then I added, I'm tired of people taking shots at Canadian hockey. When we do it, we're hooligans. But when Europeans do it, it's okay, because they're not tough or they're not dirty. That's a crock of crap. I really did feel the world was against us. I didn't even realize it was a big deal until the next morning, when I got a bunch of phone calls from friends in Canada talking about what a great press conference it had been. I remember thinking, what did I say? Typically, Canadian teams get better as the tournament goes along, and our team was no exception. We got really lucky that Belarus upset the Swedes. It was a 2 p.m. game, and I don't know if this is true, but someone told me that the Swedes were so confident about winning that Hardy Nielsen, the Swedish coach, had scheduled a 9:30 practice that morning, so the players were really tired when they played that game. They lost 4-3 on a shot from center ice that hit Swedish goalie Tommy Salo in the mask and bounced over his head. I was sitting in my hotel room in Salt Lake City when Vladimir Kopats scored that goal for Belarus with about 2 minutes left. I was so excited that I jumped up on the couch and almost hit my head on the ceiling. We wouldn't be seeing the Swedes again. We went on to beat Belarus 7-1 in the semis. And then we got to the final game against the Americans. When you're a player going into a final game, you're excited. But parents, family, friends, and coaches are really nervous. In my position, what could I do? I had to just sit there and sweat. It's so much easier when you're on the ice. When someone asked me, how do you think the game will go today? I said, well, if Mario, Sakic, and Yzerman are the best three players, we're going to win. I went down to the locker room about 2 hours before the final just to wish the guys good luck and to say hello to the coaches. I was chatting with Stevie Yzerman, who was on the trainer's table. Ken Lowe was icing down his knee and working on his leg. As I left the locker room, I said, all right, well, good luck today. I was halfway down the hallway when Ken came running after me. He said, Wayne, can I talk to you? I said, yeah, what's up? And he said, I gotta tell you this. Yzerman's knee is so bad that if this was game 7, I wouldn't let him play. I said, well, tell him thank God this is only a gold medal game. That's the kind of guy Steve was. And just as Bobby Clark wrote to Bob Nicholson about my taking over the 2002 team because, as Bobby put it, it's time to sort of let someone else do it. I felt the same way about Vancouver and Sochi. I met with Bob and told him that Stevie was a first-class guy who knows hockey. Stevie Yzerman was the right guy. Nothing was going to keep him off the ice for that game. Stevie ended up playing on one leg. I think he had surgery the next day and missed 6 weeks of the season. But there was no way he was going to miss the opportunity to play a role in that game. It was a hugely emotional game. The rink was buzzing with both the home crowd and Canadians who had made the trip. And the fact that the women's team had just won gold over the Americans in an epic game also gave the guys a lift. Both teams came out on fire. Everyone played great that game. When the Americans scored first, we didn't panic, even though it was a clean breakaway. We just harnessed that emotion and kept playing our game. Paul Kariya scored a classic for us, taking a pass from Chris Pronger that went right between Mario's skates. Then Jerome Iginla, who had a huge tournament for us, banged in another. Brian Rafalski tied it for the Americans off a point shot, but we kept coming. Sakic scored from the high circle with one of his famous riders, and we never looked back, though Brett Hull cranked one off the post. Iginla scored another, then Joe Sakic finished it off. Afterward, American Jeremy Roenick gave one of the classiest post-game interviews in the history of the game. Even though the two teams were bitter rivals and had fought hard, he tipped his hat to the Canadians and generously conceded that the better team won. But he made a more important point as well. He called the two teams possibly the best collection of players ever to be on one sheet of ice, and that he was just proud to be a part of a game like that. I felt exactly the same way. I love the Olympics, having been a part of three of them, one as a player and two in management. It's just such a great way for the game to come to non-traditional hockey people. And I know the players love playing. When I was growing up, honestly, most professional hockey players could not have cared less about the Olympic Games. And I say that not to be mean-spirited, but because when we were kids, our dream was to play in the National Hockey League, and we knew from day one that if you played in the NHL, you couldn't play in the Olympics. So very few guys set their sights on being part of the Canadian Olympic team. Now, though, hockey is such a big draw that it spills over to those people tuning in just to see ski racers and curlers and snowboarders. The Olympics, in turn, have a much bigger profile because of the game of hockey. And being in the Olympics really helps to sell our sport worldwide. We're up front and center for 3 weeks. Still, I'm worried that hockey might end up like soccer, where only under 23 teams compete. It's true that the Olympics are bigger than the athletes. But shouldn't the best athletes be competing? But it's a catch-22 situation. On the management side, I do respect and understand the risks for owners and cities. An NHL owner knows that if he loses his best player, it can put a dagger through his chances to win the Stanley Cup. If Ted Leonsis loses Alexander Ovechkin, what does that do to his franchise and his franchise's value? One solution might be for the IOC to help with making sure that the players are adequately insured in the event of a temporary or permanent disability. I think that as a league, the NHL looks at it like this. The IOC benefits from having its players compete. In fact, the hockey games make the IOC hundreds of millions of dollars. So the NHL wants some insurance, a bit of a safety net in exchange for offering up their number one assets. Yes, they're getting satisfaction because the players enjoy doing it. And yes, they're getting some exposure internationally. But if you ask the owner of a team in, say, the Southern United States, does having your players play in the Olympics help out in your market? I think he'll say no. And I will tell you that, after we'd gone to Japan in 1998, it was very difficult for the players when we came back. All the best players in the NHL, not just from Canada and the United States, but from the Czech Republic, Sweden, Finland, and Russia, were mentally and physically drained. And as a result, they weren't quite as good. Going back to regular season games in the NHL isn't going to give a player the same rush as wearing their national colors. A lot of guys slump a little when they get back, especially from somewhere as far away as Nagano or South Korea, where the next Olympics are going to be held. Or China, for that matter, where the games after that will be. Getting NHLers to the next two Olympics is going to be a big challenge. But having been there, I can say that it is worth the effort of finding a way to make it work. Chapter 31, The Culture of Winning. You hear people say it all the time. Whenever you put on a Team Canada sweater, you expect to win gold. That's not always true, and it's not always fair. It's ridiculous to think you're going to win 100% of the tournaments you enter. Sometimes the bounces don't go your way, and sometimes you just run into a better team. It has happened to me more than once. But that belief that you can win every time you step on the ice is important for every team. And so is the expectation that you should. If you don't hold yourself to very high standards, there is no way you are going to be able to dig deep enough to beat the guy you're lining up against. Perpetual winners don't win by accident. You just have to look behind the curtain to see why they've been successful. It's a culture that they've created in the locker room and that players pass on to the next generation. If you consider the most successful organizations in every team sport, and I don't mean one-year wonders, but strong organizations like the New England Patriots or the St. Louis Cardinals, there's a defined culture that runs through every part of the organization. Trust, teamwork, accountability, sacrifice. They put the pieces in place that follow the culture, and they live within it. Part of it is who they sign as players and coaches. A winning culture is often passed along from veterans to new players when they arrive. They mentor by example. You see it in Detroit, from Yzerman to Lindstrom to Datsyuk, and to the great group of young players they have now. For teams that have a lot of talented young players but haven't found success, there may be an absence of that kind of leadership. In all of pro sports, the NBA's San Antonio Spurs may represent one of the best examples of this. It goes back to May 17, 1987, when the Spurs won the NBA draft lottery and picked David Robinson as center. Then they put in place a continuity of management. Peter Holt joined the ownership group in 1993 and was CEO for 20 years. Greg Popovich has been head coach since 1996. This builds trust. They know that the team isn't going to get blown up if they ever have a bad year. New players who come in grow to greatness and stay productive for long, highly successful careers. I think the Spurs took an intellectual approach to defining the culture they wanted in that organization. Every decision made was based on it. How they train, how they have their players recover, how rookies are treated, how veterans are treated, how the veterans treat the rookies, all the way down the line. There's a way for all that to be done, and there's an expectation that it will continue to be done the right way. When Robinson retired, he'd already passed his beliefs on to Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, and Tony Parker. They've continued that culture through 5 titles. Now that they're getting up there, Kawhi Leonard has come along, and you could take it to the bank that everything he's learned from those 3 veterans is going to be part of the leadership he demonstrates to the young players the Spurs bring in. When Craig Patrick was GM in Pittsburgh in the early 90s, he traded for guys who turned a good team into Stanley Cup winners. Joey Mullen, Ulf Samuelson, and Ronnie Francis. But he also made a trade with Calgary for Czech forward Yuri Herdina in order to help out Jaromir Jagr. It was Jagr's first year, and he was homesick, ready to go back to Kladno. Guarantee that when Jagr walks into the Hall of Fame, one of the first guys he'll acknowledge will be Herdina. And when Daryl Sutter took over the LA Kings in December 2011, no disrespect to former coach Terry Murray, but they weren't in the playoffs. In a year's time, Daryl brought them to a cup win, and another 2 years later in 2014. Same team. I think it was huge to trade for Jeff Carter and Mike Richards, but still, how does that happen? Well, Daryl changed the culture. He raised the expectations and brought the best out in each player. Mess said it best recently when we were in Edmonton for the closing of the Coliseum. Every player on your team, man for man, is valuable. It's true. From your top player to your bottom player, all have to be pulling together. Daryl does that. He makes sure that everyone knows his role. Like Scotty Bowman, Daryl is really prepared. There's a game sheet with the rosters that comes out before every game. Players are supposed to read it, but they never do. In the locker room on game day, Daryl will point out the name of a new kid playing that night. He'll say to a player, "Hey, so-and-so, what about John Doe there? What do you know about him?" Well, so-and-so will have no clue. But Daryl can tell you what the kid had for breakfast that morning, what his mom and dad do for a living, what grade school he went to, and his shoe size. Everything there is to know about the kid. His practices aren't long, but they're high tempo, and he has no tolerance for lack of effort. If you screw up, make a bad pass, he'll stop the play and call you out on it. He expects your best and loses his mind on guys who aren't giving 100% in games and practice. He'll run a drill 3 or 4 times if he needs to, saying, "Do it right." Even though Daryl's hard on the players, he's hard for a reason. The best coaches seem to be that way. He's softened a little from his days in Chicago and San Jose. Back then, he was a little more intense. For any team to be successful, management, coaches, players, everyone has to buy into what the coach is selling. And everyone bought into Daryl. Whatever leadership is, the Sutter family seems to have figured it out. Daryl is just one of 6 brothers to play in the NHL, the others being Brent, Brian, Dwayne, Rich, and Ron, 4 of whom went on to become coaches or GMs. Collectively, they've won the Stanley Cup 6 times and played nearly 5,000 NHL games. Now the next generation of Sutters is coming into the league. That kind of success doesn't happen by accident. And you see it with hockey clubs. Some have figured it out, and others are still working on it. It may look as though this or that team finally succeeded because it drafted well, but that is only part of it. The history of the league is full of stacked teams who never figured it out. The dynasties are the ones who did. You can't talk about dynasties without mentioning the Montreal Canadiens. From just after World War II until the late 1960s, each NHL team was allowed to sponsor junior A and B clubs. In the 1960s, Montreal's junior A teams were the Peterborough Petes and the Montreal Junior Canadiens. NHL teams could also affiliate with minor pro teams, who could in turn each sponsor junior A teams. The junior A teams could sponsor junior B teams, who in turn sponsored midget and juvenile teams, and so on. In short, NHL teams like Montreal's had a huge network of players and teams to develop them. Until the 1967 expansion, Montreal spent twice as much as any other team on player development. In 1964, there were 300 guys at Montreal's training camp, which was held at 6 different rinks. The Canadiens would separate players from their main team, which included Jean Beliveau, Claude Provost, Henri Richard, John Ferguson, Bobby Rousseau, Ralph Backstrom, Jacques Laperriere, and all the other guys guaranteed a spot. The main players would practice at the Forum, and then whoever was having a good camp at the other rinks would be brought up for a couple of practices. Only 1 or 2 spots would be open. If you didn't make the team, you'd be sent back to Rochester or Cleveland or Des Moines or Charlotte or Houston. There were so many great players in the 60s, including Yvon Cornouet, Danny Grant, Rogie Vachon, and Mickey Redmond, who were sent back down. In the case of Jean Beliveau, it worked the other way. He was playing in the Quebec Senior League and had no interest in moving up to the NHL. He had a couple of brief call-ups with the Canadiens, but refused repeated offers to sign with them. In 1953, Montreal finally bought the entire league and turned it professional just to get Beliveau into their lineup. When I was 13 years old in 1974, we were in the dressing room about 1/2 hour before Game 1 in the Quebec International Pee Wee Hockey Tournament when Jean Béliveau came in. I couldn't believe how big he was. He looked down at me and said, I heard there's this really good player, and I just wanted to come in and say hello. Whenever I was in situations like that as a kid, I became tongue-tied. I remember just staring up at him. He laughed and said, Now don't let me down tonight. That night, our team, Brantford Terkstra Lumber, won 25-0 against a team out of Texas. I scored 7 goals and had 4 assists. When I saw my dad after the game, I said, Gee, I hope I didn't let Mr. Béliveau down. Frank Selke, who came from the Leafs and had been the Montreal Canadiens GM since 1946, put hundreds of thousands of dollars into Montreal's farm system and player development. Frank also discovered Sam Pollock, the 22-year-old coach of the midget Canadiens team. Sam, who learned quickly and ended up replacing Frank when he retired in 1964, was GM for 14 seasons. He was the architect of the Canadiens teams that won 9 cups and 7 regular season championships in the 1960s and 70s. But he was an even better forward thinker. He was first GM who traded veterans to expansion teams for draft picks. In 1971, Sam Pollock wanted to draft Guy Lafleur number 1, but at the last minute, he hesitated. Lafleur played for the Quebec Ramparts and had finished the season with 130 goals and 209 points in 62 games. But Marcel Dion was promising too, having scored 62 goals and 143 points for the OHA's St. Catharines Blackhawks in 46 games. At that time, the OHA was stronger than the Quebec League. It was a really, really tough decision. Pollock went with Flower, and Detroit got Marcel, who was later moved to L.A. and became part of the famous Triple Crown line. People have compared Lafleur's and Dion's stats over the years, wondering if Pollock made the right decision. Listen, I think they were both great players, both Hall of Famers. Marcel played 1,348 games and scored 1,771 points. His career plus-minus is 28. Flower was on 5 Stanley Cup teams. He played 1,126 games and has 1,353 points. His career plus-minus was 453. 8th overall, but he was playing on one of the greatest teams of all time. The Canadiens teams of the 1970s changed hockey. This was an era where rapid expansion from 6 teams in 1966 to 67 to 32 in 1974 to 75, 18 in the NHL and 14 in the WHA had thinned out the talent. There were no Russian players yet, and very few Americans or Europeans. The lack of skilled talent explains why there was so much violence in that era. More than any other coach, Sam Pollock wanted to sign players who were tough, but who could also skate and handle the puck. In 1971, he brought in Larry Robinson in the second round. He turned out to be one of the top Montreal defensemen of all time. But when Larry started out, his coach with the Nova Scotia Voyageurs, Al McNeil, made it clear that he could either fight or play in the International Hockey League. In his book, The Great Defender, Larry says that after getting that advice, he was involved in a bench-clearing brawl almost every game. He was a big, strong guy, and that advice served him well over the years. Even legendary heavyweights like Dave Schultz were known to turn down an invitation from Larry. Scotty Bowman, who joined the team in the 1971 to 72 season, was the coach of the second Montreal dynasty. In 1972, they added Steve Shutt, 4th overall. The next year, they drafted Bob Gainey and then Doug Risebrough the year after that. The Canadiens were so dominant by 1976 to 77 that they won 60 games and lost only 8. That's still a record for fewest losses in an 80-game season. from Montreal to St. Louis and back, and then to Buffalo, Pittsburgh, and Detroit. Every team improved when Scotty brought in a change of culture or built on the culture already in place. And in Montreal's case, that culture had been established back in the Toe Blake years. Scotty had strong beliefs about how to put a team together. Although there are three forwards on a line, he always tried to think of a twosome first. Two compatible players, and then you add a third component. When I was with the Oilers, I played with Yari Curry just about exclusively, while Glenn Sather would send different guys on and off our left wing. Because the game is so fast and physical that you don't have time to think, in my mind, the most important thing about line combinations is chemistry with a line mate. You need to know where he's going to be. Curry hardly spoke any English, and I didn't speak Finnish. But when we stepped on the ice, we played the same game. He saw the game exactly as I did. If someone was coming at him, he knew where I'd be for an outlet pass. We had that chemistry from day one. And when I look at guys today, I see that certain players have that same chemistry. Perry and Getzlaff in Anaheim, Ovechkin and Backstrom in Washington, and Ben and Sagan in Dallas. When Scotty was in Montreal, he put Guy Lafleur with Steve Schutt, and a couple of different centermen played with them. The third player was chosen depending on the team they were playing against. Sometimes they needed defensive strength, and sometimes Scotty would add an offensive player. It was the formula of that era. Mike Bossy and Brian Trottier played together with the Islanders. Mark Messier teamed with Glenn Anderson on the Oilers. The Flyers' Bobby Clark and Reggie Leach were line mates going all the way back to junior in Flin Flon. Scotty did the same thing with defensive forwards. In Montreal, he liked Doug Jarvis with Bob Gainey. In Detroit, he put Chris Draper with Kirk Maltby, maybe the best checking tandem in the league at that time. In Detroit in 1995 to 96, Bowman broke his own rule a little. He took a page from the Soviets' playbook and built a five-man unit. The Russian Five. Larionov, Fedorov, Kozlov, Konstantinov, and Fetisov. They didn't play the North American style of hockey, and it helped Detroit, because the other teams had never seen that kind of system. Scotty played them as a group about half the time, and moved them around the rest of the time. He didn't want other teams to figure out what they were doing. By moving them around a little, he wanted to make it more difficult to defend against them. Of course, five-man units mean too many defensemen and don't really work for an NHL team. It's fine if you're rolling six defense, but no NHL team does that. But still, a few times a game, the Red Wings could basically send out a line plucked from the Soviet national team, and their opponents would have no idea what to do. The Wings set a record of 62 regular season wins, beating Montreal's 1976-77 record of 60. Igor Larionov was a terrific playmaker, because he saw the ice so well. He was pretty small, about 160 pounds, but he was strong and a very agile skater. He could spin on a dime. He was an artist on the ice, very creative. Larionov believed that if you had the puck, you shouldn't be getting rid of it and chasing it. He was adept defensively, too. That was the most underrated part of his game. And like most of the Russians, he was a very unselfish player. He didn't shoot the puck a lot. He'd rather set guys up, and he was a clutch player. I always thought an awful lot of Sergei Fedorov, too. I was just amazed that he could play at such a high level. One year Detroit was short, they'd had some injuries, and so they put him on defense. There are very few players who could switch to defense like that. Most of us couldn't do it, and I'm including Mario Lemieux, Jaromir Jagr, and myself. But for a good 6 weeks, Fedorov played back there like an all-star. He was such a powerful back skater. In 1994, he was the first European to win the Hart. Vyacheslav Kozlov wasn't as big as the other Russians, but you don't have to be huge to play hockey. He was a goal scorer. He had great eye-hand coordination and an above-average shot. Kozlov was hit by a car in 1991 going to a practice in Russia. He suffered brain damage, but made a miraculous recovery. Kozlov would end up playing until he was 42, 1,182 NHL games, 853 points. Vladimir Konstantinov was drafted in the 11th round. He was a very tough guy, among the most physical Russian players ever. Anyone who thinks Russians are soft should have been paying more attention to Vlad. Konstantinov never scored a lot of goals, but he was probably one of the best defensive defensemen. His teammates would feed him the puck, and he'd shoot through the middle and create a lot of scoring chances. He loved the contact and would play a really hard-nosed game. Vyacheslav Fetisov was regarded as the best defenseman who ever played in the Russian system. I mean, no one can compare to Bobby Orr, but Fetisov liked to carry the puck and had been an exceptional skater in his youth. When he was 20, around 1978, he was one of the best in the world. Detroit got him when he was 37. He wasn't the skater he'd been in his 20s, but he could still skate out of trouble, and if he saw daylight, he was gone. There's been some controversy lately because Fetisov is on the Continental Hockey League, KHL, board of directors in Russia, and he's talking about keeping the most talented players in the country until they turn 29. That doesn't surprise me, and I'll tell you why. I know Fetisov pretty well, and there are a couple things he loves in life, and one of them was playing in the NHL. The other thing about Slava is that he's a very proud Russian. There are opportunities for him to leave illegally, but he wouldn't do it. He wanted to do it properly. He wanted to be able to go play in the NHL and still say, "I'm Russian, and Russia is my home." Now that he's part of the KHL, which is the top professional league in Europe and Asia, he wants to develop kids who'll play in and expand the league. Fetisov wants to make Russia what North America is. I don't think that's hypocritical. I think what he's trying to say to them is, "I want you to go play in the NHL, but I want you to brand our country first and build our league first." And in some ways, I agree with him. Russia is losing so many good players at a young age that the sport of hockey isn't growing as much as it used to there. And it costs a lot of money to develop players. So they're putting a ton of resources into developing these kids, only to have them leave as soon as they get good. And more importantly, he wants those young players to take pride in the system that groomed them. There was a time when no one could touch the Russians. He wants to build that pride back into the system. Now, will Fetisov be able to pull it off? I don't know. But I give him full marks, because I know he's speaking from his heart, and that he wants those kids to stay for the right reasons. No question in my mind. Of course, Detroit also had Stevie Yzerman and Chris Draper. They were really strong at center ice, and they had such big, strong forwards, Darren McCarty, Marty Lapointe, and of course, Brendan Shanahan. For a good, skilled team, they were also very tough. After Bob Probert left, they didn't dress an enforcer, and Probert was a lot more than an enforcer, since he could play the game and put the puck in the net. They were ahead of their time by building a team built around high-end skill guys who knew how to handle themselves. Ask anyone on Detroit's cup-winning teams of 1996 to 97 and 1997 to 98, whether it was the Russians who won those two cups for Detroit, and he'll tell you, it was the Red Wings. That's one thing that every good team has in common. Everyone has a role. What really made them winners was the way they came together. They were the United Nations of hockey. They had Thomas Sandstrom, who was from Finland, Matthew Dandenault and Martin Lapointe, who were French-Canadian. and Thomas Holstrom and Anders Ericsson from Sweden. They were all really proud of their cultures, cultures that the team showed a real interest in. During those years, certain guys like Stevie and Mike Vernon would step up and buy dinner for everyone on the road, and they all had to show up. And once, on a road trip to L.A., the Russians took the team to a great Russian restaurant. The entire team ate together, drank together, and hung together. They really got to know each other. They also once played paintball with the Europeans and French-speaking guys against the English-speaking North Americans, and they just had a riot. Those are the types of things that helped unify the players. At the team dinner after they captured their first cup, Steve Yzerman said in his speech that one of the reasons they won was the way they stuck together. That sort of thing doesn't happen by accident. That takes the kind of leadership that a guy like Steve provides. But the thing those Montreal and Detroit teams had in common was Scotty Bowman. Coaching is a unique part of hockey. It's different from coaching baseball or football, in that when hockey teams struggle or experience lulls in the season, players start questioning the coach more than they do in other sports. Does he know what he's doing? Is he practicing us too hard? Are we using the right systems? When things go off the rails, all pro athletes in a team environment will start looking to save themselves. Hey, it's not my fault. But a coach like Scotty Bowman will keep the emphasis on the player, never allowing him to deflect responsibility onto others. And because Scotty wouldn't tolerate crutches or excuses, he minimized distractions. His teams would stay in nice hotels and had as good a travel schedule as possible. He drilled into his players that every decision they made had to be for the team. Individuals were important. They could win trophies. But the number one goal for everyone was to win as a team. When you've got a guy like Bowman, the team stays strong because players don't dispute or revolt. The ship is never rudderless. I didn't always agree with every coach I played for, but I respected what he was trying to accomplish. I understood that if I followed whatever direction he was taking the team, it would be easier for everyone else to hop on board. I might sometimes debate the coach, talk to him about it, but ultimately I went along. My focus as a player was on one thing only, getting myself ready to play. I had to be the best I could be every night. When I started coaching the Phoenix Coyotes in August 2005, I found it to be a completely different experience from playing. Coaches have to get 20 guys ready and on the same page. I loved it. I truly did. I knew that financially we couldn't afford the caliber of players other teams had, and that we'd be a young team. Winning was going to be tough. At first, I'd tell my players, "You need to play with your instincts more." I assumed that they all understood the game as well as I did, but I should have taken into account the number of years I'd studied the game. It didn't take long to realize that, like everything else, instincts have to be developed and taught. So I put more structure into the details. I might say, "You can't go below the top of the circles on your forecheck." Whereas early on, I might have been looser about it and said something like, "Hey, when you come up and pressure that guy, make sure you force him to one side or the other." Most players need parameters. Listen, we're hockey players and professional athletes. We all have egos. The biggest challenge for me was that most guys thought they should be starting on the power play and doing the penalty killing and playing 22 minutes a game, which is actually a good thing as far as it goes, because as a professional athlete, you need to believe in yourself. I discovered that I wasn't only coaching games, I was managing people's lives. Some guys you have to build up and maybe coddle a bit, while other guys you have to bring into your office and get on them. I knew Viktor Tikhonov's son, Vasily, really well. I coached Vasily's own son, also named Viktor, on the Coyotes. You wouldn't even know young Viktor was from Russia, or that his grandfather was one of the most terrifying coaches in the history of the game. Victor is a really outgoing, nice, and fun young man, very North American. He grew up in San Jose, where his dad was the Sharks' assistant coach. Vasily was a very, very intelligent hockey man and very concerned for his son. When I had Victor in Phoenix, Vasily would come down to the locker room and talk to me, and that was okay. I had concerned mothers calling me, too. I understand that. I'm a father. Parents like to hear what's going on right from the horse's mouth. Okay, what can my son do? How can he be better? How's he doing? And we had such a young team. Adam Costas, who played for the East Bridgeton Academy Wolverines in Maine and was the son of Peter Costas, a famous golf coach and a friend of mine, was a pretty good goalie. I saw Peter at a game once and I said, I'm going to give Curtis Joseph the day off tomorrow. Why don't you bring Adam and he can play goal at practice? The next day, when the kid got on the ice, I blew the whistle and said, you go down to that net. Then Adam said, well, I got a stretch. Stretch? You're 17. Get in the net. I'm old school. Later, we were doing breakaways, and a guy came down and shot it hard, hitting Adam high in the upper chest. I blew the whistle and said, hey, listen, you guys, this kid is 17 years old. Take it easy on him. Just take it easy. Eddie Jovanovsky looked at me and said, well, Gretz, the kid who just shot on him is 18. Glenn Sather was a big believer in families being around. He didn't have many rules, but one was that everyone had to bring a date to the team Christmas party. He didn't want 8 single guys sitting at a table, only to have everyone leave before dinner ended. Half the guys would bring their mothers. I took my mom, and so did Kevin Lowe. Now, would Glenn Sather have taken those calls from concerned parents? I don't think so. But hockey has changed a lot since the 1980s, and Glenn did really like the family scenario. We'd be in Toronto getting on the team bus at Maple Leaf Gardens with Mr. and Mrs. Coffey and my mom. That just wasn't done in the hockey world at that time. If we were in playoffs in Calgary, I'd walk out for the morning skate and my dad would be standing there. Glenn would fly him out because he always felt that I played better with my dad in the arena. Glenn reached out to all the dads, including Jack Coffey, Bill McSorley, and Doug Messier. Now teams organize father trips and mother trips, but there were times in the 1980s when, if we were struggling in playoffs, he'd let your family get on the plane. He was really good about that stuff, way ahead of his time. When I coached, I learned from that. If a player came to me and said, hey, my wife's going to Vancouver. Can she fly on the charter? I'd agreed to it, and even encouraged it. Allowing only the team on the plane is dinosaur thinking. I always felt that if the players are happy, they play better. Managing your players on the bench is just as hard. I'd coached only a couple of games when the ref came over, staring at the roster sheet. He looked as if he didn't want to say anything, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen next. Finally, he blurted out, hey, there's a player missing here. It was one of our young guys, Freddie Schustrom. We'd had a couple guys coming up and down, and I'd forgotten to put his name on the sheet. Freddie had to leave the bench. Coaches like Glenn Sather and Scotty Bowman and Joel Quenneville and Daryl Sutter win so much because of great bench sense. They get the right players on the ice at the right time. More often than not, that means you're better players. But when your better players aren't working, a great bench coach can tap into the next group of guys and get the most out of them, too. He can give the lineup a shake when the team is flat. He can add some grit if that's what's called for. And he knows who has the best chance to win a face-off. The guys on the ice win or lose the game. There is no way around that. But by determining who is on the ice and guiding what they do, a coach can have a huge effect on the outcome of a game. In the 1976 finals, the Canadiens were up against Philadelphia, the defending champions, who in 74 and 75 had just won 2 consecutive cups. The Flyers' top line, Bobby Clark, Bill Barber, and Reggie Leach, had played the whole regular season together. They allowed only 28 goals against, an even strength all year. Bobby Clark led the league in plus-minus at 83. Barber was second at 74. And Leach and Montreal's Steve Schutt were tied for third at 73. At the time, there wasn't another line in the NHL that could match up. The Philly line would eat any other line for lunch. So Bowman designed four lines to neutralize them. He started with his usual checking line, Doug Jarvis, Bob Gainey, and Jim Roberts. But he didn't want to just play defense. He wanted to give that big Philly line something to worry about. So he used his scoring line, Peter Mihaljevic, Lafleur, and Schutt, and then added another line that could do both. Either Yvonne Lambert or Rick Chartrand as grinding checker, Yvonne Cornouet, an offensive threat, and Jacques Lemaire, a great forechecker and playmaker. His fourth line was young and aggressive. Doug Risebrough, Mario Tremblay, and either Murray Wilson or Yvonne Lambert. And it worked. For the next 2 years, the Canadiens faced the Boston Bruins, and those 77 and 78 finals saw some of the toughest games ever played. From 1946 to 1987, Montreal won 18 straight playoff series against Boston. They had a bitter rivalry and have played each other more than any other two teams. In 1970, when he was coaching the St. Louis Blues, Scotty had lost to the Bruins at the Stanley Cup Final. At the time, the Blues and Bruins weren't in the same class. Boston had Orr, Esposito, Busick, McKenzie, Hodge, and Stanfield. Six guys with more than 20 goals. As an expansion team, St. Louis didn't have the wherewithal to play any kind of offensive game against guys like that. So they countered with a close-checking shutdown defense and the unheard-of strategy of shadowing Bobby Orr, even though he was on the blue line. They lost. But losing to Bobby Orr doesn't make you a bad coach or a bad team. But by 1977, the big bad Bruins didn't have Bobby Orr anymore. The Bobby Orr era came to an end when number four went to Chicago as a free agent. But he played only 18 games over the course of three seasons as a result of the pain from his deteriorating knees. Boston did have Brad Park, though, one of the best defensemen ever. He could skate the puck, he could pass it, and he was no fun to play against. Guy Lafleur, for one, was pretty banged up. He played the last game of the series with bandages around his head. But Boston relied on their players' toughness. Coach Don Cherry's roster, dubbed the Lunch Pail Gang, included guys like Terry O'Reilly, John Wensink, and Stan Jonathan. Jonathan, a Mohawk, stood at just 5'7", but pound for pound, he was one of the toughest players ever. He could throw punches from either side with his left or his right. To this day, almost 40 years later, Don still shows clips of his fights on Coach's Corner. Montreal never had many guys looking for fights, but Scotty would use the other team's positives to make his own guys feel more competitive. He'd talk about how aggressive the Bruins were, how they could get on guys and turn the puck over, or he'd tell them that they needed to forecheck like Philadelphia. Larry Robinson said that praising the other teams hurt their feelings and made them try harder. But unlike when Montreal played Philadelphia in 1976, when they went up against Boston in 77 and 78, Scotty matched up his players with the Bruins individually. Doug Jarvis and Bob Gainey were used in defensive roles. They played against Jean Ratelle, who was a very underrated offensive clutch player. Jacques Lemaire centered Steve Schutt and Flower, and they became a really strong, dominating two-way line. Montreal had a real edge on defense with three all-stars, Savard, Robinson, and Lapointe. The only defensive team that was maybe better was the first Canada Cup team in 1976, which included the Montreal guys, along with Dennis Potvin and Bobby Orr, and Philadelphia's Jim Watson. Imagine having all of them on the same team. The last cup of the second Canadiens dynasty, the 1979 finals, was played against the New York Rangers, who were a miracle team. The Rangers beat out the Flyers in the quarterfinals, which was a big upset and a little controversial. They then defeated the Islanders, who'd finished first overall, in the semifinals. The Rangers had come in fifth overall, but they had Fred Shiro, a great coach. The Rangers had signed Shiro, who'd won cups in Philly in 74 and 75, and coached them to the 76 final against the Canadiens, at the start of the 1978-79 season. But because he still had a year left on his contract, the Rangers were worried about tampering charges, and so handed over their first-round draft pick to the Flyers. That pick turned out to be a guy who would eventually play with us on the Oilers and become one of my best friends, Kenny Linseman. Kenny was the agitator's agitator in the NHL.